Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.
The FT. A pension offer you can refuse. Why incentives to leave company schemes now face a crackdown. A low mortgage rate that's not worth having. Are two-year fixes a waste of time? And an end to fiddly notes and coins. Why a phone or a card is all you need in your pocket. All this to come in this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Joe Cumbo.
Hello.
Tanya Poley.
Hi.
And Elaine Moore.
Hello.
And our special studio guest, Ray Bolger, Senior Technical Manager at mortgage broker John Charkle.
Hello.
Let's start then with the money news. This week, FT Money has been making the news as well as covering it, as Pensions Minister Steve Webb responded to our reports on the incentives being offered to employees to transfer out of their company pensions. On Monday, he called a meeting of pension industry representatives and told them to root out the practice, whereby scheme members are offered superficially attractive inducements to move into less generous defined contribution plans. These incentives, which on paper are worth up to tens of thousands of pounds, are increasingly being used to persuade people in final salary pension schemes to give up generous benefits. And more companies are now offering these so-called enhanced transfer values, or ETVs, as a way to get people out of their expensive final salary schemes and reduce their future liabilities. But pension industry insiders believe the minister may be set to ban ETVs altogether. Now, Joe, it was your reporting in FT Money that helped alert the minister to this very problem. What do you think he'll now do?
Very interested to see his release, and he's using very strong language in the release in responding to the reports. He said that very worried and angered about reports of this bad practice, and he named some examples where people are getting offered cash lump sums before Christmas, etc., wants to root out this bad practice. Cash incentives are used widely across the industry, either to enhance the pension, it's called an enhancement, or on top of an enhancement to a pension. That's more when it's seen as a sweetener. But the problem is that the government has evidence that most people are ignoring advice to stay put in the final salary scheme and taking the cash incentive, that the carrot being dangled in front of them is just too good and too juicy, and they're making the wrong decisions. But there are examples where cash can work for some people, but the regulator says it's a minority of people where it may work for them to transfer out. So there is a balancing act to be done here for the minister, given his concerns. But the word I got back from the meeting, from those who attended the meeting on Monday, was that a ban is very much being considered by the government. But when I spoke to them today and I said, is it on the table? And they didn't rule that out. So it could be one of the options which comes into play.
It sounds like they are going to take very strong action here. Let's just look at an example of the sort of thing that you might be offered. Let's say you're in a final salary scheme. What kind of enhanced transfer value might you be offered, and What do you have to give up in order to accept it?
Well, I've got a case study running in the paper this week of a gentleman who had built up quite a large pot after 18 years. It was worth £350,000. So he was, you know, the liabilities going forward for the company in managing the inflation increases on that, and the benefits were quite big. They offered him 20% of that pot, which turned out to be £70,000, which he could either take as a cash lump sum, which he would have to pay tax on, or have that piled into his pension as an enhanced transfer. In return for shifting out completely, not into the company's DC scheme, but totally off the books, he would have to give up future entitlements to death benefits for his wife, for example, if he predeceased her, and also ongoing increases, inflation-linked increases, and the security of not having to worry about the investment performance, because it would continue to pay year on year. So those are the kinds of considerations that individuals have to make if they give up their scheme.
And these are very valuable benefits that people are trying to, the companies are trying to persuade people to give up.
The case study that we used, the individual was quite a sophisticated investor and wanted to take on the investment decisions and was quite secure with other sources of retirement income. So he felt there were lots of reasons, not just the cash, why he would want to give up those benefits. But the evidence is that for people who aren't in that position, that the cash is looking more of a priority for them. They're making short-term decisions and giving up the security and, taking jam today rather than tomorrow, having that peace of mind. So that's where the worry is about these cash incentives.
And very quickly, if any one of our listeners has been offered any kind of incentive to leave a scheme, what would your message to them be?
Well, the advice from the pensions regulator is, and from the pensions advisory service, is to get a full opinion on that, a fact finder and a suitability assessment to see if it really is in your best interests.
Jo, thank you very much indeed for that, and for the latest on incentivised transfers, plus an explanation of the pros and cons of transferring your pension. Make sure you read Jo's articles in the money section of this weekend's FT and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, will you ever need to carry cash again? But first, mortgages. In recent weeks, banks and building societies have been cutting their fixed rates and promoting what appear to be extremely cheap two-year fixes. It's now possible to pay as little as 2.79% fixed for 2 years. But, Tanya, you've been looking at these deals, and a lot of them now come with hefty fees and conditions attached. And isn't there a danger that they could prove a more expensive option for borrowers in the long run? Might a variable or a five-year fixed rate be better overall?
That could definitely be the case. I mean, there are still some attractive two-year deals out there which don't come with big fees and actually around the sort of 2.99% mark. And that's what a lot of the lenders are actually actively promoting. But I've got Ray Bolger here from John Charcoal. Two-year fixes still, even though they've got these cheap headline rates, they're not necessarily the kind of most attractive option for borrowers in this current climate.
For most people, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the 2.79% deal that Matthew mentioned comes with a 2% fee. Now, one of the benefits of a percentage-based fee is that it's actually pretty easy for most people to work out what the real rate is. A 2% fee on a two-year fix adds 1% to the rate. Mm-hmm. So the real rate on that deal is 3.79%. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have a flat rate fee, the effective real rate depends on the loan size. But we've seen the cost of fixed rates come down recently, and the Mortgage Works, which is a nationwide subsidiary, have just become the second lender to announce a five-year fix below 4%. They've come out with a deal at 3.99%, available up to 70% loan-to-value. Now, that deal does have a 2% fee, but, of course, a big fee on a five-year deal is much less of a problem than a big deal on a two-year deal, because if you amortise 2% over 5 years, it adds 0.4% to the rate, not 1%. So whilst I think we will see other five-year deals come out which may be better than that, that is still a good addition to the market. And the real reason for taking out a fixed rate is because you want to secure your payments, you want to know where you stand, you want to be able to budget. But the problem, in my view, with a two-year deal is that, bearing in mind the rates are about 1% less than a five-year deal, you're locking yourself into early repayment charges for 2 years. If it looks as if interest rates are going to go up more quickly than we expect, then you won't be able to come out of that deal without paying an early repayment charge, and you'll miss the opportunity to lock into a five-year fix. I actually think that rates are going to go up more slowly than the market, which is why I think that variable rates probably offer better value. But clearly, everybody will have their own view on that. And if you do want to buy security, then if you only buy that security for 2 years, A, you're buying it for a period when you least need it, because rates are clearly not going to go up very quickly. And B, if you were right to buy a fixed rate because rates have gone up, then you can guarantee that at the end of 2 years, you'll only be able to take another fixed rate out at a more expensive rate. So either way, you lose out. So whilst there will be some people for whom a 2-year fixed rate does make sense, and a good example is the Barclays deal that's just been announced in conjunction with Bovis, 3.79% fixed for 2 years to 90% loan to value if you're buying a Bovis home. That, frankly, is fantastic value because there are very few decent deals available at 90%. Mm-hmm. Yep. But for the majority of people, I don't think a 2-year fix makes sense. Either a lifetime tracker or a 5-year fix will make more sense.
And I guess it's worth pointing out that 5-year fixes, obviously they were the sub 4% mark before Christmas, and now we're starting to see that again. And that's obviously quite historically low for 5-year fixes in general, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. We did see some 5-year fixes creep below the 4% mark back in 2003 when bank rate came down to 3.5%. The lowest they got to just before Christmas was 3.69, albeit with relatively big fees. Mm-hmm. Then as swap rates moved up, fixed rate costs moved up. Now we've seen the market reassess how quickly bank rates are going to rise. Rates are coming back down, and that's now being reflected rather belatedly in the cost of fixed rate mortgages.
Do you think they could fall further? I mean, is there a sense that maybe some consumers will think, oh, we're back on a sort of downward trend for 5-year fixes, maybe I can wait a bit longer and sort of secure an even lower rate?
Well, I don't think there's any mad rush, because I think there will be more choice below 4%. I rather doubt they'll fall hugely further, but where you're starting from is absolutely key as to whether it's worth fixing. If, for example, you're thinking of remortgaging and you currently have a good, cheap lifetime tracker, then the price to you of changing to a fixed rate is actually quite a lot.
Yep.
If, on the other hand, you're with a lender that has a relatively high standard variable rate, and quite a lot of building societies have SVRs between 5 and 6%, then, of course, there's more attraction to fix. Mm-hmm. The other key point is what your loan-to-value is. If you've got plenty of equity in your property, you'll qualify for the cheapest new deals. If you've only got, say, 10 or 15% equity, you won't. But the rate you're paying on your revert to rate with your current lender will be exactly the same as somebody with only, say, a 20% loan to value mortgage. Mm-hmm. So where you're starting from is a key point as well.
Yep. I guess really you just need to actually seek advice and actually make sure you sort of really look at the cost of the deal and what's best for your circumstances.
That's absolutely right. And there are quite a lot of lenders now who on their variable rates offer a drop lock option. Mm-hmm. So even if you do have an early repayment charge on your variable rate, that will allow you to switch to a fixed rate, albeit only from that lender, without incurring the early repayment charge.
Yep. It's a bit worth pointing out also that those sometimes have a bit of a premium in terms of, like, you know, a bit more expensive than the Best Buy lifetime tracker or variable.
Some do, but not all do. Yeah. Effectively, it's one of those situations where the lender can't really justify a premium for offering that facility. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of how competitive they want to be in the tracker rate market anyway.
Okay.
Certainly worth considering. Ray, thank you ever so much. I'm still rueing the fact that I missed 3.69 fixed for 5 years. How did I miss that? Anyway, for deals of the current best fixed and tracker rate mortgage deals, look out for Tanya's article in the money section of this weekend's FT and on the website at ft.com/money. And finally today, has cash had its chips? Last week, technology brought us another step closer to becoming a cashless society with the launch of the first mobile phone payment system in the UK. Orange and Barclaycard have got together to put phone readers into 50,000 shops, which will allow customers to buy items costing up to £15 by proffering specially enabled mobile phones. But this is not the only way to rid your pockets and your purses of small change. Barclaycard has also been issuing contactless credit cards since 2007. And just a few days ago, Starbucks became the latest retailer to announce that it would be installing card readers in its UK stores. Elaine, I know all this technology is out there, and I've seen that advert with a bloke in the water slide who buys his lunch with a wave of a card. But have you ever seen anyone actually use these things?
I've never seen anybody use these cards. My card certainly doesn't have contactless payment capability. Somebody last week had to point out to me the little logo on the corner of a card that shows you whether or not you can use it for contactless payments. It looks like sort of little lines in the top corner of the card.
Right.
There's apparently millions of them out there. I've never seen anybody buy a sandwich by waving their card in front of a reader. I think it's quite hard to actually know where those readers are. They're not really flagged up in stores particularly well. So I don't think it's really taken off. What the phone providers are hoping is that this will all change with the use of contactless payment technology within mobile phones.
Yeah, this seems like it has a better chance of catching on, because I suppose everyone's now getting used to using their phone for pretty much everything.
Exactly. We like using one piece of technology to do a range of things, take photos, send messages, use email, and maybe now make payments. What's quite exciting, so we've had the UK, we've got Orange has announced this phone that came out last week. There's only one phone that you can actually make payments on, so it's still quite limited. But in the US, today, Thursday, we're expecting Google to make an announcement about a new Android phone, which will have contactless payment capability. They're still being quite, they haven't actually announced that this will come. It's been sort of reported in the technology press. So later on today, apparently in four different cities in the US, this will happen.
If Google does it, then that really could open the floodgates, couldn't it? Everyone will be at it then.
Absolutely. So Nokia, which was the world's largest provider of mobile phones, they've been looking into this for ages. We know that. They don't seem to have sort of pushed forward in providing this to a wide range of people, wide range of phones. But like you say, if Google does it, if a phone that's very desirable has this kind of capability, then, you know, it's quite likely that we would see Apple and iPhones offer it as well. And once people have an iPhone with that sort of ability, then I think everybody will want it.
Yeah, I think so. At the moment, as you point out, it's just this one phone you can use. How does it actually work? Do you get the cost of what you bought on your phone bill? Do you preload your phone with cash? Or?
You have to preload your phone. So it's not the most easy system in the world. I think we're still a couple of steps away from using your phone like you would do a credit card or a debit card. Google's chief executive has been quoted saying, this is it, mobile phones are taking over from credit cards. But we're not quite there yet. You need to load up your phone with a sum of money. I think it's about £100 in the UK. I don't know what it will be in the US. You can then use your £100 to make small payments up to £15 in shops like Pret-a-Manger or Eat, so you can buy sandwiches or hot drinks or whatever, but they have to be quite small sums, and if your £100 has run out, you can't use your phone, you have to go back to your debit card.
And the other thing, I suppose, is now that we use our phones for pretty much everything, you know, I write articles sometimes on mine. That's why they're so bad. But I've got all my contacts on there, you know, all kinds of details. If I were to lose that and it was my method of payment, I'd be completely stuck.
We are getting to the stage where you have this one very vital piece of technology in your pocket that you need for everything. In terms of using your phone for payment, what the providers are quite keen to point out is that this won't be any less safe than using a debit card. So if somebody took your phone and started making payments, you would still be covered by your bank or your building society. So you're not going to lose more money because of this. But like you say, if you lost your phone and you had no other forms of payment in your pocket, then you'd be in trouble.
Yes, I would. I don't think I'll be an early adopter of this technology somehow. But thanks for that, Elaine. And for more on all of the contactless payment options currently available, look out for Elaine's article in the Money section of this weekend's FT. But that's all we have time for in this week's FT Money Show. Remember, you will find all of these stories, plus daily news updates, blog posts and top tips on our website, ft.com/money. And you can follow our tweets at twitter.com/FTMoney. And if you've got a question that you'd like us to answer about any aspect of your finances, just email us. The address is money@FT.com. Next week, we'll bring you another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Joe, Tanya and Elaine, and our special guest, Ray Bolger of John Charcoal.
Goodbye.
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 For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.